Senate File 33, second reading.
Senate File 33, Vehicle Registration Shell Businesses, an act relating to motor vehicles.
Senator Meyer.
Yeah, I'd like to lay 33 back so we can work some amendments and bring it back on second reading tomorrow.
Senator Meyer has made a motion and a request to lay the bill back for an additional day so that he can work his two amendments into four or five of them. Without objection, Senate File 33 is laid back for an additional day. Senate File 35, second reading of the file.
Senate File 35, referendum circulator payment.
There are no amendments. Senate File 35, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, is so ordered. Senate File 36. Do we have a motion or request to lay that back? Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I would make such. I know there's an amendment in preparation, and we got to be a little careful on exactly how we do that here. So I would ask that be laid back one day, respectfully.
Without objection, Senate File 36 is laid back for second reading for one more day. Senator Case.
Mr. President, I believe we have to read the catch title, too. You've just used the number.
Let's read in the catch title, Senate File.
Senate File 36, LLC member and manager liability.
Thank you, Senator Case. Without objection, Senate File 36 is laid back for an additional day. Senate File 42, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 42, Occupational Therapy Practice Act.
We have an amendment. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, can we read in the amendment, please?
Senate File 42, second reading amendment number 1, page 6, line 1.
Mr. President, move adoption of this amendment. Mr. President, yesterday when we did the bill in Committee of the Whole, I mentioned there was one piece of fencing in this licensure bill, and what this amendment seeks to do is remove it. It relates to the telehealth services, and let me just read the line that this amendment seeks to remove. The sentence reads, the occupational therapist providing the telehealth services shall be licensed in Wyoming if the person receiving the services is in Wyoming. If you pass the amendment, that sentence will come out. This is a disagreement I have with the OT Association and the OT Board. They want to make sure it's a Wyoming licensed therapist that does it. I think the practical effect of that is going to be to eliminate most of the telehealth here, because I think most of it would come from outside. For example, we do have ties in this state to the occupational therapy school at University of North Dakota. They would be a potential source of this, and their therapists would then have to be licensed in Wyoming in order to provide telehealth here. We've seen this elsewhere. You put in this kind of thing, it's a barrier to doing it. And I think telehealth is an important way of getting services here, but understand the OTs don't agree with me. So you've got a decision to make. I urge you to vote for the amendment.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. My only question is, on this amendment, would they have to be licensed at all, or is other states close enough to our licensing that reciprocity would be fine? That, I'm just curious.
Other questions and discussion before the sponsor takes a second time? No other questions? Back to sponsor for a second time.
Mr. President, as a practical matter, they would need to have to be licensed in their home state, or they'd be in trouble in their home state. And those licenses, it's a uniform test nationally. The standards are pretty close. I don't think it would prove to be a problem. And if they did something bad, they'd be in trouble. Their home state licensing people. It's proved to be perfectly safe to do in other professions. I think it's just a matter of removing a fence that's going to get in the way of our citizens receiving services.
Any further discussion? There being none, the question is on second reading number 1 to Senate File 42. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill? There being none, Senate File 42 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Do we have any messages to read in, or should we go to general file? General file? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business, consideration of general file, bills on general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself in a committee of the whole to discuss bills on general file.
You've heard the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Would Senator Cole please come to the desk?
It's pretty fancy. I plan to have a house that are used in pushing what the deck is. Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Jeez, some short guy been sitting up here.
The committee of the whole, please come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 20. The reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 20, Sales and Use Tax Remedy Revisions, Senator Peterson, sponsor. Was referred to committee number 3 with a recommendation, was returned with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Driscoll, Landon, Peterson. Noes, Senators Case and Kinski. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Peterson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate File 20 for introduction and ask the body's favorable consideration. This is a bill that through serving as chairman revenue ran into with the Department of Revenue, and we had a problem with a recent case that was judged against the state. What happens in the cases where a vendor collects a tax from a customer or a taxpayer inadvertently, that tax is basically then given to the state. During an audit, it's discovered, or the vendor or the taxpayer might complain, but the vendor requests a reimbursement or a credit, and then the basically what happens is, and then the Department of Revenue was asking the details about it. Well, this particular case went to court, and the state lost, and the vendor was remitted the amount of money that was submitted to the Department of Revenue. The question is, and this is to close up a loophole, the question is does the vendor give that money back to the taxpayer that actually paid the tax? Right now, the way the statute reads is they don't have to prove or give a list of those taxpayers or customers, so the vendors take the money most of the time without having to prove that money goes back to taxpayers. So this is an effort to close the loophole And basically, on page 2, the meat of it begins by saying, if a vendor erroneously collects taxes from a taxpayer and remits those taxes to the department, the vendor may seek refund or credit against subsequent tax liability only after the vendor has refunded the erroneously collected tax to the taxpayer that originally paid the tax to the vendor. What we want is to make sure that that money gets back to the taxpayers who paid it instead of just to the vendors that collected it erroneously in the first place. It's just to close a loophole. That's the concept of it. Just a side note, since the time of that court hearing, that court case, $96,000 has been remitted to vendors over the last few years, over the last year, to vendors. And we don't know if that made it back to the, we doubt that it made it back to the taxpayers. This is to close that loophole, and I'd ask for your consideration.
Good discussion on Senate File 20. You ready for the question? Yes, Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my concern about this bill is that it only kind of halfway fixes it, because nothing in this bill actually assures that the vendor is going to try to get the money back to the person that bought the item. Now, I know that sometimes that's just totally unrealistic when you have a convenience store with small items and people paying cash, and it's just ridiculous. Even for larger items that people might pay with their credit card, for a dollar or two, it's just not worth it to reimburse the sales tax. But nothing in this bill says that that somehow the vendor has to try to get the taxes back to the customer. Sometimes it could be large items. And, it's even conceivable in cases where items might have qualified for things like a manufacturing exemption. It could be huge amounts. I assume those customers, though, are very smart. They'll know to go after the sales tax. But the bill doesn't say that the vendor has to try to get the money back to the customer. And I'd like to work on a fix with that. We tried and tried in committee but couldn't come up with anything. But that is a problem with this bill. It just says, the state wins out because it says it's the state doesn't have to pay it back to the vendor unless the vendor goes ahead and pays it back to the customer. But nothing tells the vendor to go ahead and pay back to the customer. And why would you do that? If I'm a vendor and I've collected sales tax and I've sent it into the state and now I find out I collected it in error, well, where's my incentive to contact the customer? Because if I have to pay the customer back first before I can even apply to the state. It's not worth the hassle and I come out even. So I think this bill needs some more work.
A discussion? Senator Peterson, I just got to find you here. You're in a different spot than you used to be.
Find me? There you go. Point well taken. Missing, keep the eye on the ball here. We're trying to close a loophole, and there is wording in this bill that allows this money to get back to the taxpayer. But there has to be some evidence to the department of who those taxpayers are to ensure that they get their money back, not to the vendors. Right now the vendors pocket it. I'm a businessman myself. Some of these nickel and dime transactions, you're not going to be able to prove. But nobody questions those transactions with that small amount. It's the larger transactions. And I misstated, Mr. Chairman, the court case. It was not a court case. It was a ruling by the State Board of Equalization. But that ruling has affected our general fund $96,000. And so we have to close up this loophole. Let the vendors prove that they have collected this tax to these specific taxpayers, and we want to make sure that that money gets back to the taxpayers and not just end up with the vendors. And that's what's happening right now. So let's close the loophole. Thank you.
Further discussion on Senate File 20? Senator Anderson, where are you? There you
are. Mr. Chairman, as to the question of whether the vendor gives the money back, I thought that was covered on page 3, line 20 through 23. Says if a vendor erroneously collects taxes from a taxpayer and remits these taxes to the department, the vendor may seek a credit against subsequent tax liability or a refund only after the vendor has refunded the erroneously collected tax. Sounds to me like he has to show that he paid the taxpayer back before he gets these taxes.
Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think that's the exact language that we're talking about here. They may seek a refund from the state only after they've paid the taxpayer back. Fair enough. But if they're, it's a wash, why would they want to seek a refund from the state? Because all the only way they're going to get a refund from the state is if they pay the taxpayer back. And it doesn't say they must refund the taxpayer to you know, in all instances. The word may only applies to whether they can want to seek it from the state or not. If they want to seek it from the state, they have to have done the first step, which is to pay the taxpayer back. But if they don't want to seek it from the state, they don't have to do the first step.
Further discussion on Senate File 20. Questions on Senator Peterson's motion that Senate File 20 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 20 is passed Committee of the Whole.
Senator Geis.
The motion when you do these bills is I move when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports.
He's right.
That's the motion you make when you present these bills.
For the benefit, that's from experience and history. So, thank you, Senator Geis. Next bill for our consideration, Senate File 21. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 21, Mineral Tax Archaic Provisions, an act relating to mine product taxes, sponsored by the Revenue Committee, was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which reports back the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Case, Driscoll, Kinski, Landon, and Peterson. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with favorable consideration on Senate File 21 and ask for the body's favorable consideration. This is, again, a revenue bill. This is just deleting archaic provisions, wording. I think I've given a few examples on introduction. It takes care of a lot of this unnecessary wording, cleans up our statutes a little bit, asks the body's favorable consideration. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Senator, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, but they deal with page 4 to the Revenue Chairman, and that deals with severance tax on both oil and gas, and specifically on line 11, the little 3I, I think that's a 2% severance tax that you have stripper wells. But on the definition of stripper, that this, in fact, would be a credit for stripper wells. The question I have is to be sure that the way stripper wells are calculated, it's not based on each individual well in the field, but you take the total number of wells in the field and the production and divide by it, and if it's under those thresholds, then it's considered stripper wells. I want to be sure that we haven't taken away that particular statute that's been in place for years and years, and this doesn't affect that.
Discussion? Further discussion on Senate File 21, Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I do understand the Majority Floor Leader's point. We'll check that out. We, in committee, the discussion and the testimony, and there were members from producing oil and gas interests in Wyoming in the committee, and you know, everybody thought the bill was okay. Honestly, they did, but we will check that out for second reading and get an answer for you.
Senator Peterson.
Echo that. You can see what we were trying to do. They were tied to that specific date of January 1999 through December 31st, 1999, but we want to make sure that those rates are still applicable, so we'll get that information to you.
Questions on Senator Peterson's motion that Senate File 21 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Senate File 21 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration. Senate File 8. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File 8, Bicycle and Pedestrian System Task Force, sponsored by the Travel Committee. Was referred to the Travel Committee, which returned a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Barnard, Cooper, Kraft, and Johnson. Senator Cooper, Chairman.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises and reports that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 8 Bicycle and Pedestrian System Task Force do pass. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment number one. If I could, I'd like to have that read in at this time.
Reading clerk, please read the standing committee amendment.
Senate File 8, Standing Committee Amendment 1, page 1, line 14.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 8. And, Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do, I'll go through the bill and explain the bill, and at the same time I'll point out where the amendments are made. I think that would be a little bit more explanatory than just picking them out separately because they're fairly minor.
Just let us know when you want to vote on the Standing Committee Amendment.
I will, Mr. Chairman. And before I ask for a vote on the bill, I'll ask for a vote on the amendment. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, this relates to a task force to study the benefits and opportunities of a bicycle and pedestrian pathways. And if you see down in Section 1, it represents originally 11 members that were supposed to be that would be appointed by the governor to this task force. Now, I'd like to also point out that this is a point where there was an amendment made, and now the number there has changed to 13 rather than 11. And what we did, we had a request by the livestock people and by the trucking association to add a member from each of their associations to the task force. And if you go on page 2, you can see all the members. I won't list them all here today for you. You can read through there and see the different members and groups that are on this task force. Many of them are government agency people. Some are from the private sector also. If you go to page 3, I'd like to point out that we're talking about at the end of the members list, this is where we added the two new members. On line 12 there, we added one member from, of course, the ag industry, as I mentioned earlier, and we added another member from the trucking industry, and that was a part of the amendment. Mr. Chairman, also on line 18 on page 3, it starts and begins talking about the fact that there will be two reports that will be due from this task force, one early on this year, and then one later on that will report back to the committee. And also on page 4 now, we start talking about identifying and evaluating the options that can be used to fund these programs. As you see, there's no funding appropriation in this bill, but the task force will work on types of funding, whether it's state or local or government or private or individual corporate funding and so forth, and just simply identify those possibilities. Much of the work the committee will do also will have to do with safety analysis, as it talks about at the bottom of that page. And then on page 5, this is where another part of the amendment comes in, Mr. Chairman. On line 17 there, we added Section J and K, and those sections have to do with Section J is to add to consider implementation of the annual lifetime passes to be used as on state trails, and these passes would possibly have fees attached to them that would be revenue-generating fees back to the state. And then K would simply says to include task force could include any other consideration as a task force that they may deem appropriate for these bike trails and pathways. Then, as I mentioned earlier, there is two reports due. There's a preliminary report due on October 1st, 2016, and then a final report on October the 1st, 2017. Mr. Chairman, service on this task force, as I mentioned in the introduction, is all the people who are employees of agencies of the state would be paid for out of their own government organizations. And then also we got a commitment from all those in private organizations that they would be willing to pay for their own people on the task force and would not be asking for reimbursement for those people serving on that. Mr. Chairman, this is the bill and it's in what it encompasses. And at this time, I would like to ask for a vote on the amendment as I have explained.
The question's on the Standing Committee Amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment's been adopted. Back on the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, with that then, one of the things that the committee looked at with this and thought it would be a good addition to the state, because one of the things we found out on the committee is that there's been tremendous interest in particularly tourism, for biking and those types of things, and we felt that this might be a revenue-generating source for particularly for some of our, even our smaller communities could be incorporate this, and since we have a lot of public lands, we could use those and lots of the rights of ways that we have in and along those federal land managed areas, Mr. Chairman. And we think also that it would be good just for the simple good health of the people of Wyoming to do bicycling and walking on pathways. Mr. Chairman, that's the bill itself, and ask for your favorable consideration.
Any further discussion on Senate File 8, the bike and hike bill?
Mr. Chairman.
The question's on...
Hello.
I don't know why I thought of that. The question's on Senator Cooper's motion that Senate File 8 pass committee... Oh, excuse me, Senator Hicks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a question for the sponsors on the bill. When I look through all the things they're supposed to study and stuff, the one thing that I'm not finding that drives a question is where in all this process is they going to identify the locations of where these trails might be? We're going to study a whole bunch of things here, but I'm just curious as to if there's part of the job is actually to go out and identify where these trails might be. So,
Senator Cooper, before you stand up, Majority Floor Leader Bebout has a question as well. Majority Floor Leader Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And specifically on page 5, starting with line 10, subsection G, the most cost-effective method of construction. And, you know, Wyoming is a huge state with lots of highways. And if we start looking at trying to construct bicycle and pedestrian pathways along some of these long, winding roads of our state, the cost would be exorbitant. I'm wondering how you're going to approach that and what the revenue source would be to offset those costs. The other question along that vein, Mr. Chairman, is federal highway funds. Do they, in fact, prohibit the use of those funds for, quote, bicycle paths on interstate highways or highways that are funded with our Fed funds? And it could be our U.S. 20, 26, some of those highways as well. So could we utilize those funds, or do we have any problems with the feds if we don't?
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, on with regard to the first question, I think maybe the senator has put his finger on something that's needed here. The bill last year required development of a plan with some priorities. That may be a good idea. That's maybe something we could consider on second reading. With regard to the second question, my understanding from talking last year to the director of the Transportation Department was that there is some federal highway money that is set aside for this sort of thing. I think there's one or two other things you can do with it other than bicycle pathways, but that is a potential source of funding for some of them. Now, you're right. This is a big state. You would need to set some priorities in terms of where was the most important to do this, because you obviously aren't going to have them anywhere. We couldn't afford that. And it would be a gradual process, but there are a number of sources of funding that are not state general fund or state transportation funds that potentially are available to assist in this. And if we set some priorities, and as this bill says, say what's the most cost-effective way of doing it, and it may be different depending on the volume of use you expect and the particular circumstances you're under, then you can start to have a rational, gradual development that the first pieces will do us the most good in terms of things that our citizens can use and in terms of attracting some tourist business in.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To continue that discussion, one of the concerns, you know, we all understand we have dwindling revenue sources and there's a lot of competition for those dollars, not only on our state highways, but you have the cities, towns, and counties that are trying to do things or passing the local one-set tax. Have you talked to cities, towns, and counties about their support of this? Are they supportive of looking at funding for this? Do they understand the competition it will have with other funds? Is it something they're in favor of, or do they have concerns?
Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman. Oops. Okay, are we on? Okay. Mr. Chairman, one of the things we did on it, the committee, there were folks there that were during the interim that were from local government and were in support of this. And one of the things was, we did include local government people on this task force, too, so that they can be a part of it. And they had a very keen interest in this bill. I think I answered your question.
Mr. President.
Holy crap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, one of the good things about this bill is I look to see that there's no requirements that a member of the legislature be appointed. And because if there had been a member of the legislature appointed, then we'd have the discussion that our former colleague from the eastern southeast part of the state used to talk about, task force. Former president said, we've had enough of these task force. What's the purpose for it? But I frankly am struggling with the idea that the legislature is going to pass a bill that's not a legislative task force. It directs the executive branch to do that which he can do without being told what to do. It assembles a group of people to do things that they could do by if they want to without being told to do it. And, in effect, what we're telling the executive branch is that you can't figure this out, so we're going to tell you what to do. But when the report's generated, we're going to say that's the result of a legislative task force, which it's not. So you elevate the status of a report put together by a very, very narrow segment. There are other problems. First of all, some of these begin on page 4. I don't think you need to have a task force. Consider the health benefits of riding a bicycle. Really? Consider the opportunities for using bicycle pedestrian pathways. Really? I need to have a study for that. One of my colleagues from other county, I guess, just said an interesting thing, and that's true. You create these entities that have a semi-public authority about them. And we've had these in Albany County where you create a group of folks that get together and then they get designated by the city council to be something of interest. And then they pull out a ranch map and they start finding all the mountain bike trails that they'd want to ride through to somebody's ranch and get up to Pilot Knob or get over to Kirk Gowdy Park. And then all of a sudden these maps start, your ranch all of a sudden appears on somebody else's website and has a very high potential use for trails because it's of great interest. And it was put together by a task force that the legislature created but doesn't govern. And you're like, well, what business do you have putting trails on my road? Now, if what we're talking about is should highways be wider? Now, I ride a road bike and a mountain bike, and I love riding on highways that have wide strips on the side, shoulders. And I prefer it if there's no gravel on it. Most people do. But you don't need to have the script go out and say that if you're going to be building a highway and you have the resources, build a wider. And if we want to tell YDOT, look, go out and start planning a bicycle network along the roads. I think they're already doing that, but if they're not, just tell them to do it. Ask them to do it. But instead, we create an executive task force without our participation, directing them to do that which they can already do, and to create a report that somehow has a greater elevation because we told them to go do it.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, you still need to do it. And
frankly, we tell the executive branch what to do all the time. That's a major part of what we do down here. And that's the way it should be. And you have here something that doesn't necessarily fit into any one executive department. Significant part of the effort will come out of the highway department. They're the ones that know about the safety features here. They're the ones that govern the right-of-ways that in many cases will be used. But they are not fully under the control of the chief executive. You know, the highway commission is pretty autonomous, and the highway department pretty autonomous. And you have some agencies that ought to be involved here, like the business council, like the folks that they promote tourism and whatnot, that have quite an interest here and that understand the kind of a statewide system and the pieces of it that will pay off the best if we're going to try to build our tourist industry. So we're cutting across a number of executive agencies, and that's a classic case where you need an impetus from the legislature. You don't need a member of the legislature on that, but we do need to give them some direction what we're looking for, or it's not going to happen effectively, because the highway department is independent of the tourism people that know where the things need to be done. And the with regard to the local governments, they do have an important role here. And in a number of cases, they have already taken the lead locally. We've got one through our town, from the western end of town, clear over to the eastern end of town, the Platte River Parkway that is heavily used. But it's known locally very well. But you need to have it designated as a part of a state system so that it is effectively promoted to people that are organizing bicycle tours. Oh, you can get through the Casper urban area very nicely. Pinedale's done the same thing. Has a branch up to Fremont Lake. Has a branch goes out at least as far as the road to Cora. Jackson has done the same thing. I think there's in a number of other communities that have. So the local people are already involved, and this bill puts local representatives on it. It is something we need to do because it's an opportunity that we are not now taking advantage of, and this is the time when we've got an opportunity that isn't going to cost us general fund money, that isn't going to cost us our highway money. We need to be sensitive to and take advantage of, and I think the committee has done a good job putting together a bill that is the first step. And yes, it will go on, and it will grow, and it needs to, because, frankly, there's money to be made for some of our businesses. There's money, there's jobs to be had for some of our citizens, but you have to put it all together into something that's commercially viable and attractive, and the businesses that are involved are small enough so they can't possibly do it on their own. You've got to link together a whole bunch of communities and have something that makes sense. So I hope that answers the questions.
Mr. President, first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I'm convinced, but I'm willing to be convinced that we certainly know we have autonomous agencies out there. We have the highway department governed principally by the commission, the tourism commission, tourism group, and business council are governed by independent boards and executive offices. So I suppose you could say your objections would be fine and well taken if there was some belligerence within the agencies and unwilling to work together. But having said all that, then I think the challenge on second reading and throughout is to make sure that this is exactly what you've described. And that is, it's a state system on state highways, state right-of-ways, and public areas. And that their task is limited to assembling using state resources for state uses. And that this is not an exercise to go out and talk about
well, where would we like to have access, or where would we like to go, and whose property do we want to go on? So it's important that if it is a state system, that the authority and the capacity for recommendation is limited to providing these pathways and these opportunities on state right-of-ways and using state resources and assets.
Senator Hicks first, Senator Scott, then I'll get right to you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, kind of expand the discussion from the President. The way I read this, and it says, study the benefits and opportunities of bicycles and pedestrian pathways and natural surface trails in the state. Well, let's talk about what that says to me, is there's literally 50 or 48% of the state of Wyoming is owned by the federal government. There exists today probably thousands and thousands of miles of natural surface trails through the state of Wyoming on the federal domain. You can go buy a Forest Service map. They show all these trails. You can pick up a BLM map. They show all of these trails. So when I look at this thing is so broad and nebulous, I don't know exactly what they're supposed to be studying. Are we going to look at these trails in addition to those on state right-of-ways? Or is this specifically restricted to state right-of-ways? I don't know. But the scope of this thing right now is it's every natural surface trail in the state of Wyoming. This is a scope of work that nobody could undertake through this task force. And quite frankly, it sets it up to the point they may spend 2 years trying to decide what they're actually supposed to study. So until we narrow this down, get some specifics of what we're actually looking at for trails and pathways, I don't know where we're going with this legislation. It's a rudderless ship. And I don't know where it's going to take us, Mr. Chairman. So I got a lot of questions on here with the scope that it's defined today is what are we trying to accomplish? And if it does incorporate those components of bringing in the federal domain and all those existing natural surface trails out there, we probably ought to bring in somebody from the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service to participate on this task force too. So I got a lot of questions as to what the scope of this study and this task force is actually supposed to do.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, let me respond to one of the items in terms of restricting it to state. I think that would be a mistake because you will find from time to time some non-state, non-publicly owned places. It makes a lot of sense to put one of these. And you can sometimes get that done. I know with the Platte River Parkway in Casper that's an existing bike and pedestrian trail, and very heavily used and very popular in the community. One of the things that comes through west of the city's Morad Park, and before you get to where the Game and Fish Regional Office is, it comes through a piece of property that is owned by the local Audubon Society. And the Platte River Parkway sponsors approached the society and said, we want to do this. And the Audubon Society looked at it and said, yeah, it will be a big benefit to the public. It's consistent with what we're doing, and gave their permission. And it was a piece that made the whole rest of the thing, that whole Western Park, make sense. Wasn't very much land, but you do want to leave that opportunity open. Another example, there's a piece that goes through the land of one of our major manufacturing operations, goes through between where they actually have their plant and the river. Heck, they got permission for that. I think they may have even persuaded the company to pay for paving it. It was a voluntary thing. So you do need to leave that opportunity open. I don't see this as a widespread use of private land, but there will be occasions where it makes sense and occasions where the owner will say, okay, yeah, that makes sense, and I'll go along and help out with the project. So you need to leave the opportunity open. I will say with regard to the BLM, the Forest Service, I think most of their efforts aren't suitable for a general bike pathway. This is more a hiking kind of thing or wildland hiking kind of thing, and probably aren't going to be much affected by this one way or the other.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, another task force. I just look at it, and I know that these things are always the proverbial camel's nose under the tent. We know that whatever the task force does, and they come back with a report, there's going to be a price tag associated with it because, frankly, most of the major metropolitan areas have some kind of bike path system now. Could they be better? Could they be enhanced? Absolutely. Are there any funds to do that? Well, folks, we know in this budget that, and probably the next few budgets down the road, even if you got the best plan, if you don't have money to follow your plan or implement it, it's a futile, basically a futile exercise. And that's what I think this task force is going to be. They might come back with some great recommendations. But until the climate changes a little bit, I think you're going to have a serious problem trying to implement anything in on a statewide basis or on a community basis that the task force might come up with. You know, and frankly, they are going to come back probably not next year, but the next year, they're going to come back in and say, boy, we would like to do this, 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 and this. And you're asking for what's the best way to construct it? Well, construction costs money. We all know that. You know, so, you know, I guess we're basically giving people false hope that they're going to get something out of this because I don't think it's going to come back. I remember back in the 90s when we argued tooth and nail over $100,000 because there wasn't any money in the pot. In the pot. And, folks, even though we've got a huge rainy day fund, this thing could last 10 years. And we're going to blow through that $2 billion like it wasn't even there. You know, so, I mean, this is a lot of hard decisions. And the reason it probably doesn't have an appropriation because the appropriation committee probably wouldn't have passed it out or would have passed it out with a do-not-pass recommendation. You know, it's a way to get the ball rolling and looking like it's done cheap, but frankly, the business council, they've got enough to do. They've had a lot of cuts over there, and they've had to cut, and I don't know whether they're going to have that the time to go ahead and move forward on this. But if they need to move forward on it, I mean, they can do it unilaterally. They can go to the governor and say, can we get a couple of these folks in here to help us from transportation and tourism? And, yeah, there's a lot of projects out there. I'd love to have a tour of Wyoming, like the tour of France, you know, bring in lots of big crowds and make it a heck of a deal. But, you know, they can limit what they're going to do. They can limit their scope. But I don't think it's our place to go ahead and try to get the camel in the tent when there just isn't room in the tent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, I keep my bicycle in the garage, not in a tent. And I think that things are going to get so bad financially that we're all going to be reduced to driving bicycles around.
Yay!
And I think we better prepare for it. Now, that might sound kind of silly, Mr. Chairman, but biking is a really big deal, you guys. It's really a big deal. A lot of people do it. A lot of communities have made impressive strides in their livability by building bike paths and embracing bicycling. But for me, the most important piece of all this is that we're going to think about safety. Because, you know, for about 50 years, maybe longer, highways have been designed for cars. And that's great. But I'll tell you what, cars and bicycles don't mix very well. And we've had several tragedies in Fremont County and Natrona County. I know you've had some just horrific things. Now, is this going to fix that? No, of course it's not going to be a panacea in that. But to begin to think as we think about the transportation systems of the future and how we accommodate different uses and how we integrate bicycle and roadway traffic and that we think about really the best way, Mr. Chairman, is to plan, when we do plans for the future, is to separate the traffic to the best we can. And, you know, it makes for a very livable community. There's no money in the thing. You can have all these arguments about how broke we are when they come back and ask you for money, if they do. That's fair, absolutely fair. But for right now, to begin to think about a different future that is more accommodating to bicycles and does a better job of protecting the safety of our citizens is not a bad idea. And when we get to an appropriate point, I'd like to have a privilege of the floor to make an introduction, Mr. Chairman, but that can wait till you're ready.
Senator Barnard, where are you?
And I think we can answer a lot of these questions if you turn to page 3.
Mike.
Well, I don't have him on. Just a minute, Senator Barnard.
Now,
are you turned on?
If you turn to page 3, start on line 18, it says, this says, develop a report to help the Department of Transportation. Develop a report to help. Stop right there. Go down to line 21 and say, better understand the opportunities and challenges of bicycle and pedestrian pathways. That's all this is doing. We haven't ordered any statewide study to initiate a trail system anyplace. It's just trying to help these different organizations, towns, cities, and a state, know how to construct these trails better, how to get money from them, get input from people that are using the horses, using the trails in an equestrian manner. It's just a matter. This is just a way to help start the discussion to these other things. And I don't see this as such a big deal.
Further discussion on Senate File 8. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, the TRW committee heard a lot on this bike path things. In September, we heard testimony from YDOT that they're currently trying to get this inventory done. We need an inventory of our bike paths in the state to be able to apply for federal funds. We will no longer be able to apply for federal funds in the future if we don't have an inventory done. So they are working on that. So what they couldn't do was get into the local focus. They can only do the statewide system. So they were asking for some help from the local guys to put their trail maps on the thing also, of which the cities and counties were more than happy to do. YDOT could not do the economic development part of this either, what a benefit it would be to the state or to the businesses in the state. So they were asking for help from that on that point from the committee. We heard again in November on bike paths from the realtors who said it was a plus for them to be able to sell real estate if they could have this bicycle plan done and have an inventory of the paths. We also heard from private enterprise county commissioners that they want to have this done and put in one place and not have everybody in the state working on it. Thank you.
Question. Senator Dockstader.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the work that the committee went through on this. When I first looked at it, I was probably had the same concerns as my colleague next to me. Where are we going to? Eventually, it's all going to turn into money somewhere with a request, but we're not there yet. And I looked around at this body, and I thought, well, is this the right body to talk about bicycles with? I looked around. I said, I started trying to envision some of you on bicycles, and it wasn't working. So I backed off that whole thought process. And I think about the next generation that comes out around me. When I go home, it's not my generation, but the young parents who are raising their kids, they tie those little tandem things on, put their babies and their kids back there, and they're all out there riding bikes. And so I think we have to think in terms of the next generation that's coming along. At the same time, we have to be very careful that it doesn't turn into a money request down the road. So let's move the bill along.
Question. Further discussion on Santa File 8, the hike and bike bill? Bike and hike? We're on Senator Cooper's motion that Santa File 8 pass committee of the whole. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed nay?
No.
Santa File 8 is passed committee of the whole. Mr. President.
The privilege of the floor.
Privilege of the floor.
Folks, with this new environment, we thought a little bit about how you're going to use the microphone systems. In fact, we know we have some dead spots and blind spots among us. Right now, I don't even know if Floyd's or Senator Exabel is even in the House. He might be over there somewhere, but he's in a dead spot. It's like can I hear you now? So here are the issues we have to deal with. We actually investigated to put some additional microphones on the corners so that folks could use them, much like the House has where you have the corner mics. Each one of those would have cost about $1,000 or more. And so on your behalf, I said, no, we're not going to do that. So my first reaction when I came down was that everybody should use their own mic and face the president or the chair. Now, if we exhibit courtesies to each other to allow each other to use their microphones, and we can try using this, and it's fair enough to say if one of our colleagues turns around and uses the back microphone, there are some protocols that we have to observe. First of all, one is that you always address your comments to the chair and to the president or whoever is residing on the dais. The difficulty with turning around and facing your members is you're not adhering to the rules of parliamentary debate that require that you face and make your comments to the chair. But we have to also recognize that this is one of the few times where the people who are in the back rows have an advantage because the folks up in the front cannot really address their colleagues without facing the chair. So the default is, and it always has been, your comments are addressed to the front, to the chair, and to the president. Now, if we begin to use each other's microphones, you have to honor the same things. And if you think about what we did in the Capitol, you could stand off to the side, but you would be facing the chair, so you have the chair in your eye, and you're facing the chair. And it always worked because there, all of our desks had outside pathways. Now the problem is we've got interior folks that cannot go to a pathway where they could face the chair. And so if our folks in the front turn around and use their colleague's microphone, they cannot see the chair, and they're not addressing the chair any longer. So what my proposal is that we'll let the rules be balanced here for a while, but when you choose a mic to turn, you cannot choose the mic that's directly to you facing the you always have to have your face somehow turned to the chair. You have to have your eye on the chair, so the chair does not have to interrupt you, because the chair should never have to interrupt you. You should be facing the chair. The chair is the person that controls the speech, and that's to whom you're directed. So inevitably, if you turn around, your back is towards the chair, your back is to your colleagues, and that's not appropriate decorum for debate. So the front row people, think about how to do it. It may have been that you use, in this case, Senator Pappas's mic, and then you at least can view the chair at the same time. The side view and the chair, you're still going to have people to your back, but you'll have a broader communication in front. But adhere to the rules. All comments are addressed to the chair, and you must view the chair at all times, and you're just simply going to have to make it a problem, and that's even true for the corners. On the front, you can't turn your back to the chair. That's an overriding principle that we have to adhere to. Thank you.
Well said, Mr. President. Senator Case.
The floor, please, Mr. Chairman.
Privilege of the floor.
I'd like to do our first lineup introduction behind the glass, if it's possible, Mr. Chairman. So in this first round effort of the Police Beat 101, I have some friends from Fremont County, Lander, and around the state of Wyoming, and even friends from other states, who are the board of directors and the staff of the Nature Conservancy of Wyoming. As you recall, we had a resolution for them a couple of years ago, and we recognized their efforts and their anniversary. And Senator Schiffer, of course, was with us then, and he's been very instrumental. So I'd like to ask the Nature Conservancy staff and board of directors to stand, and we can behind the glass for the lineup.
Yes!
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to our humble digs here. You're always welcome here, and it's nice to see you. Next bill for our consideration in Committee of the Whole, Senate File 14. Reading clerk, please read the Senate file.
Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency, an act relating to education, sponsored by the Education Committee. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which reported back the same with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Coe, Dockstader, Landon, Pappas, and Rothfuss. Senator Coe, Chairman.
Senator Landon. I thought I had you on. I did.
You and me, Mr. Chairman, right here.
Now you're turned on.
There we go. All right.
I got you.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 14. We do have a standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, I would ask that that be read in at this time.
Reading clerk, read the standing committee amendment.
Senate File 14, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 3.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the standing committee amendment, and at this time I'd like to yield the microphone to Senator Rothfuss for an explanation of the bill.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in this position, I can see everybody perfectly except the president. So. Mr. Chairman, I bring Senate File 14, Student Data Privacy and Transparency, from the Joint Education Interim Committee. Mr. Chairman, this legislation was a product of the Digital Information Privacy Task Force during the interim, and it comprises a significant number of topics that were raised. During the interim, the Digital Information Privacy Task Force focused primarily on education issues, K-12 and the universities and colleges around the state. This legislation addresses a number of those issues that were raised and targets specifically the student data privacy through the K-12 system. As we work through the bill, there's a few different topics that are involved, and the first one that we see starting on page 2 discusses what is effectively social media accounts. We refer to them in this statute as digital information accounts, but other states have passed legislation targeting how districts, schools, teachers, administrators should handle access to, requesting access to, and reading emails, social media, text messages, content of cell phones, etc. And we found through testimony that our districts around the state didn't know specifically how they should handle those types of situations. They had different policies in place, and it was difficult for them to understand a bright line, so this helps to provide that. And what it lays out on page 2 in Romanet 1 is basically that it's prohibited for any officer or employee of a school district to require or request a student or prospective student to disclose or provide access to a digital information account through the student's or prospective student's username, password, or other means of authentication. So the concept here is that a school employee, district employee, cannot require a student disclose their username and password. And that's basically the theme that goes throughout this. We'll see some exceptions and there's some further clarifications, but for this first part of the legislation, that's the key concept. You can see in Romanet 2, it's also prohibited to require a student provide access in the presence of an employee or officer, in other words, the over-the-shoulder surfing type concept where, well, you log in, I'll look over your shoulder, I'll read all of the stuff that you've been writing, all of the private information. It's precluded to compel a student or prospective student to add someone as a friend or an associate in any of the social media sites, so you can't say, well, you make me a friend on your Facebook page or else. And then on page 3 in Romanets 4 and 5, it talks about the fact that it's also prohibited to exclude or discharge or discipline a student for failing to provide that type of access or disclosure, or requiring a student or prospective student to waive any of the rights provided under this. The concept that was presented by some of these large companies that you've all heard of that testified to the committee and discussed with the committee is that it's not just the student's privacy that's usually at risk in these situations if you're providing a username and password as access to one of these social media accounts. You have to remember that they're a member of a community, and that if you have access to that account, you have access to private information of all of the members of that community. You have private information and communications in email exchanges. Out-of-state people that we have theoretically no authority over, would then have their privacy also infringed upon in the interest of the school. So those large corporations that you've heard of basically take the position that it's unacceptable for someone to assume an identity to go into a Facebook account, an email account, or anywhere else and assume that because it's a violation, first of all, of their terms and policies, but also of their individual privacy rights. So the next part on page 3 gets into, well, what can be done? And you see in section B there that nothing in this section shall prohibit an officer or employee of the school district from Romanet 1 conducting an investigation. So you can ask questions, you can do what you need to do, you can do all the things that are going to be required for anti-bullying and everything else, short of asking for that username and password. So you cannot assume their identity, but you can certainly conduct investigations. And then Romanet 2 is sort of the key provision, and this is where we draw the line. You can't ask that child or compel the child to provide the information, but you are certainly entitled to ask the parents. If the school district, if the employee, if the principal, if the building leader, whoever else really feels that they need some additional information, they are welcome to bring the parents in. The parents then can act as that legally responsible entity and decide whether or not it's a reasonable request, whether information should be disclosed or whatever else. And again, it's reasonable based on how we operate in our schools that the parent is the representative of that child. And if the school or district wants to make a request to invade that child's privacy, they need to do so in cooperation with the parent, not just by compelling the child under circumstances where the child is being threatened with expulsion. It goes on to preclude in Romanet 3, that it's certainly allowable to view anything that's already in the public space. So if you can find it without requiring the username or password, you're entitled to use it as you see fit. And then the C provision indicates that if it's a school district-provided resource, that's a whole different game. Nothing precludes school district resources from being accessed in the standard manner which they are right now. D indicates that it doesn't create a duty for an officer or employee of the district to search or monitor. And E is a penalty provision for this clause, which indicates that it would be a misdemeanor violation of $1,000 for the first violation or $2,500 for any additional violation. This, Mr. Chairman, is where the amendment comes in. I believe that amendment has already been moved, if I'm not mistaken, by my good friend from Casper. So at this point in time, I would just read that into the text here, and you can see that we're changing that. The Joint Education Committee decided that was a bit too onerous of a fine, potential fine. So the Joint Education Committee recommended lowering those values from $1,000 for the first violation to $250 and from $2,500 for each subsequent violation to $1,000, which is certainly a friendly amendment and supported by members of the original task force. So if there's no questions or discussion on that particular aspect of it, I'd call for the question on that before. Well, let's see. We probably need to move on before I do it. No, we'll stop. We'll stop there, maybe.
The question's on the Standing Committee Amendment. All in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. That's been adopted. Back on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, moving on then, that focuses on that social media section, and we've got in F a definition of digital information account, which means an electronic service or account used to communicate or store digital assets. So it encompasses email, social media, and other similar types of technologies. At the bottom of page 5, we put another obligation on the duties of the state superintendent with regard to digital information privacy for students. And going on to page 6 at the bottom, in the new section K is the key concept here, which is that the State Department of Education would then be obligated to, in cooperation with the Enterprise Technology Services, develop a data security plan that includes standards and protocols to remove personally identifiable information to conduct data collection and analysis without disclosing the identity of the student. The concept there is something we've discussed many times in this chamber, which is trying to minimize the amount of information that the state collects on students of the state. This is trying to get the department to work a little more on anonymizing or de-identifying our students in their data collections and puts an additional onus on them to do so. So that's something we've certainly heard a lot of testimony about on Joint Education Committee over the years, on education accountability. So we looked at it in the task force, and we're requesting that the Department of Education, through that clause, find new ways to the best of their ability to de-identify the data that they collect. And the third key concept that we have here on page 7 beginning is overall right now the districts in the state of Wyoming really have no statutory compulsion to protect the privacy of the student data beyond FERPA, the federal laws that govern it. So what this is trying to do is provide guidelines on how the district should go about doing that. And on page 8, there's a requirement that each district have a policy. There is not a lot of specificity on what that policy is, and that's intentional, because different districts are going to have different abilities. So the key concept here is that guidelines will be produced among the districts in cooperation with our Enterprise Technology Service and the Department of Audit and the school districts. And from that, then, the guidance will be used by the individual districts to basically do the best they can in the near term. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Christensen, just a second here. I've got to find you. Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The question for the sponsor was posed by an educator, and with the example being, if another student discloses to the educator that the neighboring student has threatened suicide in their notebook, their personal notebook, they can have access to that and look at that. But if that same student, according to their understanding, is that same student puts it in Facebook, then they've got to get a warrant to see if that child's going to do something to themselves. And that was their concern about the delay when it comes to harm and the immediacy of having to seek warrants and so forth if there's a threat out there, when in the paper form, you know, they could look at it. So why the difference? And is that accurate?
Senator Hicks first.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a question for the sponsor on here. One of the things that I would like some clarification, so when I look through the, you can't require or request a student or a prospective student to disclose his username or access. And we go through the, so we look at the exceptions to the requirement of requiring a student to give you the information to get into their account. You cannot do that under this bill. My concern is what happens if you have one student come up and say, hey, on so-and-so's email, I got a thing that he's going to come in and bring a bomb into school tomorrow and detonate it, or there's going to be a mass shooting, or one of these things. And the way I read this, it says nothing in this section shall prohibit an officer or an employee of the school district from doing certain things, but they still, under those circumstances, when they have information that there may be a deadly shooting going on in that school, and one of these students, you can't go in and get their user account. You can't compel that student to say, you need to show me in your email what you're sending out there. Am I correct in that assumption? Because that's the way I read this, that if there's information out there that you can't get into this student's email or digital information anyway, anyhow, under this law.
Further discussion? Senator Von Fladern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for the sponsor, and does that you use digital information account a lot, and is it an account only like my iPad? If I brought my own personal iPad, could the school make me open it up, see what's written there, but not let them get the password to get into Facebook or Twitter or whatever else I may be using? So is digital account just mean Facebook, Twitter, you know, other accounts, and not the tablet itself?
Further questions? Senator Esquibel.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there was, if at some point the student or other students waived their right to privacy, is there some point where they waived their right to privacy?
Any other questions? Further questions? Senator Office, do you want to answer some of these questions?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And these are all good questions, and these are certainly the types of questions that we spend a lot of time on in the Digital Information Privacy Task Force, because unfortunately there's no easy place to draw the line on this. Privacy rights make knowing things more difficult. There's no two ways about it. So somewhere you have to figure out how much privacy you give a student versus how much you want to know what they're doing. And this basically gets at the username and password side as being that bright line. To address the question specifically, going to the good senator from the northwestern part of the state's concerns about another student disclosing ideas on whether or not it has changed. Am I having a picture taken of me by the president? What does he want? Oh, he wants to hang it up so he can see me behind the post. I understand. All right, it makes a lot more sense now instead of it being a floating head that he hears off in the distance. Now he can look at me. That's good. So as far as providing an additional delay, and this goes to the same types of questions about the imminent threat, the bomb idea or something along those lines, adding that factor. Well, the reality is if you have that imminent threat, you're certainly allowed to bring that person to your office. This does not preclude you from doing all of the normal things you do. You just can't say, I need your username and password. Well, what could you say in that instance? You could say, we're bringing your mom in, or we're bringing your dad in. Let's get your parents here. Let's get them on the phone. You could also say, this is serious. We're calling law enforcement, and they're going to get a warrant that is going to allow us to read your email. Absolutely acceptable. It just precludes you from saying, I, as the principal, have some suspicions. I need your username and password for all of your social media accounts, which is a very different thing. Again, there's plenty of opportunity in the case of a serious emergency where there's an imminent threat to handle this in a way that it should be handled. And realistically, I don't think you do want to say, well, this is an imminent threat. There's a bomb risk here, but I'm going to go ahead and handle it myself as the building administrator. I truly hope law enforcement gets involved in that situation. And if it doesn't rise to the point of law enforcement, perhaps it rises to the level where you bring the parents in. And if it doesn't rise to that, you probably don't have any business looking at their email or their Facebook accounts. So that's how we tried to draw that line and set up a clear delineation. And I'm not saying it's perfect because I can't say that. If there's one thing we learned in that Digital Information Privacy Task Force over the time, it is that this is a difficult thing to work with. Which is why search and seizure has always been difficult for the U.S. Supreme Court under the Fourth Amendment. These problems evolve over time. We've had recent court decisions that deal with smartphones, which has changed how that's searched versus previous times. So there are challenges here. I can't deny that. But we really did our best to balance those student privacy rights and erect those devices versus the interests of the public schools. Now, as far as the digital information account, whether or not you'd have access, really it comes down to, is there a username and password? And beyond that, it's like the notepad. We had a lot of conversations about a piece of paper in my backpack versus a piece of paper in a sealed envelope in my backpack as a student. And there are going to be different levels of rights and responsibilities right now for a school district. If there's a piece of paper out, I think we all know and we have an expectation that the school is going to be able to have access to that. That kind of goes what the good senator was talking about. So if it's available, if it's information that I can pick up, if it's a note that's being handed back and forth, there's probably a good chance of that. But it's generally accepted that you can't be opening that envelope. So this goes more towards the sealed envelope where there is an expectation of privacy, and unless you have some type of extenuating circumstances that would bring in the parents or bring in the police, that's a privacy barrier, and that's similar to what this digital information account is getting at. And as far as waiving the right to privacy, there's always some difficulty when you're including students. We see this in the Joint Education Committee and elsewhere, in that the school does have a responsibility acting on behalf of the parents to protect those students. So you do get into different levels of privacy, and the courts have held that time and again, that schools have different rights for those students that they're protecting than standard public rights. So there is an expectation of some infringement on privacy, which is why they can search that bag or search the locker and do a lot of the things they do. But at the same point, there still is an expectation of privacy, specifically on these personal accounts. These are not school accounts. These are personal accounts, and that expectation of privacy should be maintained, particularly if the parents want it to be. Because, again, you're acting on behalf of the parents. So if you can't get the parents to go along with you when you bring them in, maybe a court does need to be involved, and that's okay, because that's part of the process that this intended. So hopefully that addresses the questions, and again, I'm happy to answer more. This is it's a very tricky area, and it was hard to draw these lines.
Further discussion? Questions on Senator Lana's motion that Senate File 14 pass Committee of the Whole, all in favor? Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, a question again for the sponsor on this, and I think I heard the answer, but I want to be really clear on this, and maybe I wasn't explicit in my question was, so if a school resource officer or a school administrator has a clear and imminent threat that doesn't have time to call the police, and hopefully they show up in 15 minutes, or in some cases in our rural schools, could be an hour, and they have a credible threat that there's going to be a school shooting or that there is going to be a bomb or there's going to be some type of thing on it. The way I read this law, and I just want to make clear that that resource officer and that information is on that child's email account, that that person could not compel that student to say, I need you to get in to your email account right now or give me your account and your password because I need that now, if there is an imminent and immediate threat in that school. On the way I read that, and based on your discussion, the answer is absolutely not. Am I clear on that?
Senator Raffis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The green light.
Oh, I got the wrong one on. Just there you go.
There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, I mean, that was exactly as I took the question, and the answer was clearly no, you cannot compel that student unless you wanted to be in violation of a misdemeanor. And if you felt it was worth $250 because it was that imminent, and honestly, I can't think of any scenario we haven't handled. So when there's an imminent threat, if that child that you've identified is the threat or somebody who's involved, there are plenty of ways to handle this. So I'm really struggling to see how we haven't taken care of it. But let's say there is one, it'll cost you $250. And I have a feeling that the scenario that we're laying out here as the most extreme example that, again, I'm struggling to come up with, but if it does happen, the school administrator probably would take the risk in that instance, and I'm going to guess they wouldn't be prosecuted. But at the same time, the school resource officer that was mentioned is going to be a peace officer. And when they have an imminent risk, they can compel things that are based on law enforcement compulsions, so that would be taken care of all by itself. It would be outside of this. That school resource officer is going to be operating under law enforcement rules as opposed to school administrator rules, and they know when they can and can't compel and do searches and do other things along those lines. So it would be operating differently. But at the end of the day, again, the statute would require bringing in the parent or calling law enforcement under that circumstance, which, again, I really think is the best, but if there is that scenario where we've got 30 seconds to get access to the email account, then maybe they'd risk the misdemeanor.
Senator Landon?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just real quickly, it's interesting that good senator from Beggs, I asked the same questions in committee, and we had a great discussion about it. I think here's an answer in part to your question. There's a good chance that school resource officer got the information from somebody telling him about that Facebook account, for example. So remember that. But I just wanted to remind the body, there's two things about this bill that really brought me around to it. Other than the overall notion of privacy, which I think is one of the real compelling things about the bill in the first place, I like the parent piece because I think it's very, very appropriate that school administrators and teachers cannot just hold something over a student's head and require them to give away their privacy without their parents involved. And then the second piece, you remember for the past three or four sessions, senators, we've been talking about data privacy. I think I and several other folks in here have brought some legislation related to data privacy. And we've heard testimony over two different interims that data privacy is a problem not at the state level, but at the school district level. And this bill does a great job of addressing that, Mr. Chairman. I think those are two great pieces in this bill. We can continue the conversation about whether or not we want to violate some of that privacy. And isn't it interesting that we're talking about privacy today, and in a couple of days we're going to be talking about school safety and security? You're always going to have polar opposites coming together. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Landon. Any further discussion? The question's on Senator Landon's motion that Senate File 14 pass Committee of the Whole. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 14 is passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Landon, will you take the chair, please?
Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 32. Would the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 32, Alternative School Accountability, an act relating to the Wyoming Education in Accountability Act. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which returned a committee recommendation of due pass. Senators Coe, Dockstader, Landon, Pappas, and Rothfuss. Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, move when the committee of the whole rise and report it do so with due pass recommendation on Senate File 32. Members of the Senate, in the 2011 session laws, we passed the Wyoming Accountability and Education Act. And at approximately the same time, I believe, maybe give or take a year, we put a moratorium on alternative schools, creation of alternative schools. Well, we took that moratorium off, I think, in the 2014 session. What this bill does, members of the Senate, is it brings alternative schools into the fold of the Wyoming Accountability and Education Act.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I'll come back to you, Senator Coe, in just a moment, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and I have to apologize to the body.
Oh, me too. Me too.
Mike.
Me too. I just realized.
My apologies. You're on.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have to apologize to the body. This does contain an appropriation, and it would not re-refer to the Appropriations Committee, so I would ask the good chairman of the Education Committee if he might want to do that.
Thank you, Senator Bebout. Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been here long enough to know that, but I would ask, I would request that Senate File 32 be referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations.
Without further objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 32 will be re-referred.
I probably have to do that. That's fine.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I ask that we beg leave to rise and sit again in 10 minutes.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
That's all right. My fault.
Mr. Chairman, before we adjourn, without further order, there a motion having been made to re-refer the prior bill, which is number 32, without further objection, the bill is re-referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations, the referral occurring by the President. Any messages before we take a 10-minute break? What we want to do, I think, is read in before some reports on standing committees. Is that right? The next item is a report from standing committees.
February 10th, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, to whom is referred Senate File 7, Landfill Remediation Priority List, respectfully reports back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anderson, Coe, Cooper, Rothfuss, and Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. February 10th, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, to whom is referred Senate File 57, Freestanding Emergency Center, respectfully reports back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Peterson, Scott. No, Senator Driscoll. Senator Scott, Chairman. February 10th, 2016, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, to whom was referred Senate File 43, Workforce Investment Act Statutory Reference Amendments, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Boner, Kraft, Driscoll, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Mr. Majority, are there any other messages that we'd like to read in now?
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk for right now. Do you want to take a short break? Motion is to take a 10-minute recess. The Senate shall stand in recess till the sound of the gavel in about 10 minutes. Yeah, but I wrote this.